Kia ora, greetings and welcome to Green Planet FM 104.6. I'm Tim Lynch and I trust that you are doing well. I invite you to stay with me over the next hour as we discuss and find ways to take care of our unique and magnificent green planet Earth. As we enter an era of conscious choice and responsibility, it is prudent that we realize that we, as a human species, are totally integrated into the web of life that we call nature. When we immerse ourselves into the subtle cycles of the natural world and surrender to the beauty and majesty of the physical world, a renewed sense of connection, of a quiet power and a mysterious virtue can flood our being. This is when we become poetic. This is when love can flow and expand from the heart. When we have reference for the web of relationships that we all share the same breath and that all life begets life in a continuous lineage of eggs and umbilical cords, we come into the realization that all life is sacred. Becoming ecologically aware is the new paradigm that takes us beyond left and right-wing politics. When birthed into this world, we are able to breathe deeply of fresh air that this planet provides via the reciprocity of plankton and vegetation. And when we drink of pure, unchemically treated water that falls on our roof or comes to us via a mountain stream, we baptize our consciousness to a higher frequency. And to eat and ingest from an organic food chain that nourishes our vehicle, the body that we inhabit, that is loaned to us from the repository of our planet's elements, this awakens us to insights that empowers us to act for the benefit of the whole. When we consciously make choices to cut back our ecological footprint and to embrace sustainability, we realize that we can make a difference and that we are the ones we have been waiting for. In the studio this morning, I have Diana Shand, who is the Regional Councillor for Oceania of the IUCN, the International Union for Conservation of Nature. So kia ora and thank you very much, Diana, for coming in and wanting to share.
Kia ora. It's great to be here, Tim.
The IUCN is the world's oldest and largest global environmental network. It's got a democratic union of more than 1,000 governments and NGO member organisations and almost 11,000 volunteer scientists in 160 countries. That's huge. How is it that we don't hear of the IUCN?
Well, it is amazing, isn't it, that we have this resource, this extraordinary organisation, and it hasn't managed to be a household word. Like WWF, for example, which it founded, and a lot of people don't realise that. So I think it's something to do with scientists. It was scientists' organisation in the beginning, and it says the world about scientists not being able to communicate very clearly, but boy, are we addressing it now. You go to an international conference and IUCN will be the organisation that's called on for scientific information, for networks, for its six commissions. It is an extraordinary organisation, well recognised in the world where science and veritas counts.
Because it's marketing, they lose in the marketing. The corporations of the world are just steamrolling the scientists, and the scientists, I've heard a lot, are extremely frustrated, but they don't have the ability to articulate really what's happening.
Well, I think we're getting better and better. I'm not a scientist myself, but I think that those in the conservation environment world looking at the scientific basis that needs to be communicated and educated and everybody to be aware of, I think it is becoming more and more skillful. And I am amazed at the resources that are available and how they get out. Now, for example, IUCN has a commission on education and communication, and this commission has extraordinary resources and is used across the world by those who actually want to communicate with communities at the lowest level or with politicians at the highest level in terms of scientific fact, resources, communication tools, techniques. It is really there and it is used. But there are other commissions as well, and they all have their place. For example, the World Commission on Protected Areas, another IUCN commission, has an extraordinary recognition across the world. It's set the classifications that are used globally and recognized, and it is an organization that has supported, influenced, and helped governments and scientists and communities actually recognize the value of protected areas and supported them in doing so.
My frustration, Diana, has been around the fact that there are, say in this case, 11,000 scientists. Well, $100 each, they could put out an extremely high quality film or video, $1,000 each, and we're all volunteers, would be able to possibly get the top people in media to really put the story across so that the householders of New Zealand really understand what is happening. Lots of people are too busy fighting over the remote to see who's going to win the game next Saturday to recognise that we even live on a planet. And many people are getting frustrated. I mean, you'll know David Suzuki was in New Zealand just the other day, extremely upset that the fact that the scientific community are not being able to get the story across.
Well, I'm not sure that it is the fault of the scientific community. I go to Australia and other countries, and in actual fact, there is far more on every channel I turn to than there is in New Zealand about climate change, for example. It has really worried me how the media in New Zealand don't think this is newsworthy. So I am concerned. I am concerned about the message that is not getting across with all the resources that are available. I mean, if any of the listeners will let them Google, for example, Love Not Loss, a wonderful little 4-minute video which communicates the kind of new understanding of how we should be communicating to people about biodiversity loss. So we've just had this global conference in Nagoya looking at the 10-year mark of the Convention on Biological Diversity, which was first signed at the Rio de Janeiro Earth Summit, and considering how it's going to be carried on. And IUCN was called on at every point by the chair. It was in running workshops, it had side events, it had a delegation of about 60 people. Its presence was very strongly felt where it was needed. But it would be the organisation that organisations turn to, and it would be the organisation that governments refer to. For example, it does have a unique place in the world, Tim, because it's the only organisation I know where governments and community organisations are members side by side and sitting down together, as we are, for example, in the New Zealand Committee of IUCN, for example, and the Australian Committee, the African Committee, whatever it is. We are actually members side by side of IUCN. When it comes to the World Congress, held every 4 years, then there are two houses, one for governments and government agencies and one for community groups, and any resolution has to pass in both houses. But I would say that it's very, very important to recognise this unique nature. And we're the very rare organisation that has a permanent seat at the UN.
Yeah, that's very important.
Observer status.
Yes, I understand. Mm. How about New Zealand government, particularly with the ACT Party being able to influence the National Party? Do you feel that we should be sitting beside the Minister for the Environment and the Minister for Conservation? Are they communicating with you all the time? Because you have got so many people in the field. This is where the information comes from, is in many cases from all your scientists.
Well, I know that government departments do refer to IUCN, or particularly the Department of Conservation, which is the state member for IUCN, for New Zealand government. We also have Landcare Research and the New Zealand Conservation Authority as state agency members of IUCN. And they sit with us in the committee, New Zealand Committee. and they draw extensively on the information that is brought forward. And I know, for example, in the Schedule 4 debate, the fact that the Director General of IUCN, together with the Chair of the World Commission of Protected Areas, wrote to the New Zealand government expressing international concern about taking protected areas off the Schedule 4 for the consideration for mining. And that really was recognised as international concern speaking and had an effect.
So, Diana, where do you think or see the great conservation challenges in, say, New Zealand Oceania over the next 10 years or so?
Well, goodness, Tim, this is...
That's right. Huge.
I don't know which one you pick out, but, of course, some you do feel have overarching influence, and climate change would be one of those. And the other unspoken one, I think, is population growth across the world. But climate change, of course, is affecting our already diminishing natural resources, which are increasingly eroded and degraded by population demand and population growth with growing demand. It's terrible, the cycle that we're entering into. And smart businesses should be recognising this along with everybody else. And some of them are, of course, although there's a tendency that if you think a resource is diminishing, that you go in and plunder it to the nth degree, because we don't have strong enough government regulation in many places. And this is what is happening with, say, for example, fish stocks. Well, in that case, we don't have really laws on the high seas that are strong enough or effective enough. People look after their economic. And so it is a very difficult business when you look at what is what in terms of the interconnectedness between climate change, acidification of the oceans, diminishing water resources, the deforestation, the natural erosion of biodiversity, however, which is being increased over 1,000 times by human demand and pressures. Where do I choose? What is the biggest conservation challenge? It's an incredible situation we're facing ourselves. And what we have to consider is the effect for humanity. We are living in the here and now. We're making business decisions for the here and now and for me and my mates, for a lot of us. That is the real problem.
It is a huge problem. The Old Boy Network does not understand. They don't know how to nurture. They know how to plunder and take.
And, of course, governments are not sending strong enough signals. I mean, we don't pay for the cost of pollution of waterways in the way we should. We don't really pay the proper cost for using water. It's a matter of get in there while you can and use it while you can and put out an economic argument that this supplies jobs. But downstream, the pollution is terrible and affects jobs, and it will affect all sorts of matters of economic concern in New Zealand. And downstream in time, this is a terrible clean-up job we might have to do and a terrible loss we might have to face. So we are not making decisions for all living things. We're not making decisions for future populations.
Yes, so how can we meet all these challenges? The first thing, of course, is the awareness of humanity. We've got to basically get it that we're on a planet that's got limited resources.
Finite resources.
That's right. So Barry Commoner's limits to growth from way back in all those years, and we still don't recognise it. We're still, as you say, grabbing as much as we can in the meantime. The short-term idea of just profit. A CEO comes into a corporation, and if he can have three quarters during that year where he can make a profit, then he moves on to the next corporation. They're not actually really looking at sustainability to the degree that all the CEOs are there to make the shareholders get a better return.
Well, Tim, you're absolutely right. The sustainability of the company they're looking at, and probably the future profits of the company if they look that far ahead, and some of the implications for the sustainability of the planet and the sustainability of humanity, are not there in the decision-making at all. So it's really important that you have enlightened business and you have governments sending market signals that are recognised, because otherwise businesses will complain, we're not on a level playing field. So if you penalise me for taking water when somebody else can come in and take it in another way, then that's going to be something that's unfair, unequal. Don't charge me for taking water just because I've recently got a consent, for example. You've got to charge everybody. Or don't penalise me for pollution when there are other people polluting waterways or air or land in different ways. So we really have to think holistically, and we really have to get the message across for every sector of society. And we also have to recognise that fear, if you introduce some of these things, fear pulls the blinds down over the eyes and over the mind. And so really laying out the facts sometimes is counterproductive. And we have to grapple with that too.
That's a real difficult one, because people say, oh, I just can't face it anymore. Turn off the TV, I don't want to know about it. And yet we have to be courageous. This is a time for boldness. And our community are too busy wanting to get distracted. And I've been in the game for 35 years of the environmental world and realised the hurdles. And we're still rolling backwards in some ways, and yet more and more people also are becoming aware. But particularly when the problem came out of East Anglia and the email so-called scam, and when Copenhagen fell over and nothing really came of it, the environmental movement has been in many ways on the back foot. There's no real good initiatives happening. There's no excitement there. Like if Peter Blake had been alive today in this country, New Zealand would have been out there in front. We would have been movers and shakers in the environmental field. But when we look around in New Zealand now, we're still having difficulty finding a way forward on this.
Isn't it interesting you identify Peter Blake? I think you've got something there. We need charismatic, articulate leaders. And we don't seem to have a particular charismatic, iconic leader leading us at the moment. It's a bit sad. No one voice coming over another. And yet there are wonderful people in New Zealand, quite extraordinary people working in their own way in the field of climate change or biodiversity or whatever you might look at. And even out on the land, there's extraordinary farmers, organic farmers pioneering new approaches. There are people. I hate lumping people into one lot, like saying all farmers are desecrating or degrading the land. It's just not true. I come from a farming family myself. This is not what is happening. There are some in every walk of life that are degrading, despoiling, greedy, and short-sighted. And there are others that are recognizing this or have the potential to recognize it. Now, you ask me, how do we tackle this? I really struggle myself, but I often think there are a few keys that we should be turning. One of them, I think, is starting right at the community. Why don't we have environmental education as a core curriculum subject? Permeating every single school subject and matter and recognised as an absolute essential for future planning, whether you're in business, whether you're in public service or whatever. Whether you're a lawyer, you need to understand what sustainable development is. Deal with a Resource Management Act, and you've got to understand the implication of the information and the evidence that's put before you for a resource consent, for example. So I served on a regional council for 15 years, and I tell you, it did disturb me at times that there didn't seem to be understanding by people that really had the ultimate choice, ultimate decision in their hands. Not of the intricacies of interconnectedness of ecology and the scientific basis. This is the concern that I have. You might hear the scientific evidence, but you don't really grasp the full ramifications of whatever's being decided. So environmental education, I think, a great commitment to environmental education is really important. Now, the other thing is, we are just not sending the signals clearly enough, and part of that is to do the way we measure our economic system. You know, our economic system is just ineffectual in terms of measuring the realities of life. We have gross national product, which is going to show economic activity that is good or bad, regardless of whether it's good or bad, whether it's unsustainable or sustainable. Economists across the world are starting to realise this, and they are looking for alternatives. They are deeply concerned about the fact that, you know, you can have an earthquake in Canterbury, for example, that's going to really rev up economic activity, but it's a disaster.
It's a loss.
People.
It's a loss, not a gain.
Absolutely.
The indexes, having a look at these economic indicators, and indexes are so important, aren't they?
Yes.
Where car crashes and going to hospitals, all these, should we say, downside effects are seen as part of economic growth.
Precisely. So, you know, what is success? Is it just gaining more material things if you're an individual and accumulating more money? Or is it actually good health and a wonderful environment to live in? What is success if you're a company or a business? What's success if you are a government? And it's about time we looked at some of the things that are really important in the lives of populations, of communities, of individual families. So some of the considerations are being given to what are the ingredients of prosperity? What are the real matters that are important to people? We should be measuring economic progress by those sort of things, maternal health or number of people in school or number of people above the poverty line, and better, number of people that finish high school, number of people that have access to an open space and can see the sky. This is a very important aspect. So I would recommend reading. There's quite a few books being written about it now. Prosperity Without Growth by Tim Jackson, the economic advisor to the Sustainability Council of the UK. Fantastic, clear exposition of that particular approach. So let's look for prosperity without growth. People have probably heard of, you know, the happiness index, which is really an exciting concept. And why not? Why not actually consider the things that really matter and not just material accumulation or economic activity that could be measuring earthquake loss as and restoration as much as, or fishing loss and fisheries loss as much as gain. So I think that's an aspect that I would look at. Then as well, I think simply the matter of considering how we send those messages. And I would really like to see a move to a system of polluter pays that's real. And I think that we need to have a better taxing system than we do now. And governments have to be clearer and stronger in their messages about what's really important. They do have the scientific advisors at hand. They do have the real communities reporting to them of losses and problems that are increasing. So I think that's very important. But on the global scale, I don't know how we tackle some of these things except being wise. You know, just to give you an example, there's a most terrible land grab going on across the world at the moment. And it's just amazing when you look at it. In Africa, it's estimated that 75,000 square miles have been acquired by foreign interests in Africa, just in terms of big corporations buying up land, looking at the future food basket needs.
And the minerals underneath we don't know about.
And the minerals, this is just another thing, and they're deforesting. They're actually chopping down forests at the same time they're doing this. There's the loss of forests in Brazil, for example. Absolutely appalling. It's all about clearing forests to grow soy, for example, and that's to do with population growth, of course, but it's also about the escalating demand for timber products, including paper, escalating demand for food, and the rapid shift towards a biofuel production economy, and the damage of that, I hope, has recently been brought home by the facts that have been laid out about the clearances of forests in Indonesia, some of the last great forests, intact forests, carbon sinks they are, sequestering carbon, giving livelihoods to so many peoples there, being cleared in vast spaces, given over to palm oil plantations for biofuel, and then, of course, the palm kernels that New Zealand purchased 25% of the palm kernels in the world for feeding our so-called ecologically sustainable
Clean Green
New Zealand. That's just so sad and tragic, and will be found out soon. It's very dangerous.
Yes.
And it is absolutely wrong. Shall we actually contributing to this loss of natural forest and carbon sequestration?
So there's a big battle going on, really, between the sustainability front and the corporations who are just wanting to carry on like a juggernaut. There doesn't seem to be any constraints, as you say. The United Nations, which in many ways I support so much of it, is still a toothless organisation, and yet it's got so many officers and representatives around our planet who are resourced to get information. And the UN have got some very sort of far-seeing Agenda 21, which is an interesting story, because the people who loathe it, who hate it, are the control freaks who want to hold on to everything, and the ones who actually want to implement it in many ways are, shall we say, more for the greater good. They're more community-oriented, etc., and want to share more. And you have so many different forces working to get their piece of the action, when I know that every spaceman who's gone out into space, and I've read a lot about the Russians who've gone up, they look down from their orbiting spaceship, and for the first day they just note their own country most of all, and then the next day they start to look over the borders, and after the third day they actually see we as one human race. And then if they're up there for 6 months, then they have this major connection to the fact that we are one humanity, and how can we resolve all our difficulties. And they see the deforestation, they see the colours of the rivers and etc. And it's only when you get outside, away from this very, very limited three-dimensional world, out into space and look at our planet as a whole, then we understand how, you know, fragile in many ways we are. Even though the planet is a fairly robust planet, all the different ecosystems from the atmosphere right down to hundreds of feet below the soil surface, it's just a magnificent interrelationship of all these organisms, and it's only the spacemen who can see it. It's not the politicians and the leaders. I don't know how we're going to get around this, but if we see and feel things,
I think we have to translate that view from space. You know, we should be looking at this precious planet, Earth, our home, and saying, this is the only home we have. There is no planet B. We really do not want to move from this precious home, and we don't want to destroy it. You know, it's a very sad thing, isn't it, that the economy is the concept of the care of the home. That was the original
Greek word.
The
yes.
Greek word, mm. And yet we've built it on a artificial concept of an entity called the company. If we were still looking after the home, I think we'd be better off. And it is our home. And the blue planet, that's what they see from those wonderful images that were sent back. And we suddenly realise we are on a watery planet. Yet, you know, now we're facing shortages of water on land, and the sea is sucking up all this carbon dioxide that we are expelling, and or ensuring through our emissions is trapped, and it's being absorbed in the ocean. And ocean acidification is a huge concern with all the problems that arise from that, because if you've got an acid ocean, you're going to lose all the carbon forms within marine life. So it's all dissolved away eventually. So it's tragic. We're losing coral reefs that protect lands, so forth. But look, enough about the problems. How do we move forward? Well, I think it's very important that people do really start to feel that they have an individual chance to do something. It is very important that everybody knows that their knowledge is important, and they accumulate knowledge and learn about it, and that they can influence others. It's just wonderful now to think that we don't smoke in New Zealand in every turn. So, you know, it's a combination of regulation and then behavioural change. Who'd want to smoke near a baby now? It's just extraordinary. So let's get that thinking about how do we care for our planet permeating through everything we do.
We need to focus on the children. I like to always mention in this program that we're here to take care of children's future. And I know that in many cases, Indigenous peoples have a connection, not only with nature, but with their family, and of course Māori in particular, they always acknowledge the ancestors. They will always give thanks to where they are now. And of course, Tangiroa was the god of the ocean, and so when they went out fishing, they would have a karakia, and of course, to tāne the forest, if they're going to cut down a tree. So there is a reverence. They see things as more sacred, whereas the Māori in particular, looking back to their whakapapa and acknowledging the past, the white man in many cases doesn't really look back to our past. Most of us white people here in this country cannot really follow back our family tree very far, but the white man does do something, instead consumes the future. It takes the future, whereas we got it round the wrong way in many cases. So I feel that having your children and your grandchildren around you and thinking, how are these little beings going to enjoy their life?
Yeah,
it's critical. It's
absolutely critical. I would have to say that most civilizations, most communities have been guilty of despoiling the environment. Even Māori, you know, when you look at the demise of the moa and burning to flush them out of the forest, there was lots of damage there. But they probably just got wiser, and they also had this spiritual connection and have kept it high. And I think the problem with Pākehā is that we haven't kept this spiritual connection, this reverence that you talked about, high in our agenda. And it's a bit of a concern that we are, you know, really eulogizing and really give accolades to the worst things, aren't we? We say that somebody has died, that they were a great success if they accumulated a great fortune, but we should be remembering where they actually had a very light footprint on the land, and they left a bright and healthy future for their children.
A legacy.
Mm. Yes. These sort of things, I think, will swim back into view as we realise difficulties facing us, and it is lovely to see community awards going to people that have made the community stronger and richer in the things that really count and have contributed to conservation and the environment. So supporting those sort of things is something that an individual can do, can't they? They can ring up a radio station every time they hear a good program and say, we want more of that. Like this program, Tim.
Thank you.
And I think that we can do a lot. We can be a lot more vocal about actually sending the message that these things count. And the good old letters to the paper, all those sort of things don't help. Calling your politician, all of that really helps. So let's get conservation and the environment back high on the agenda, because I know that that's what politicians watch, and they won't vote for things in the House if they think that's going to lose them votes. We've got to give the message that it will give them votes. So that's a very important concept. And as well, I think that we really need to actually support our young leaders, our young kids going forward, and equip them with knowledge. And we can do a lot of that and support businesses that are going for eco-friendly things, are actually looking for the new technologies that genuinely cut out waste and genuinely are going to be less heavy on the environment. So we have a big part to play. In fact, I've heard people say that really the controllers of the future are going to be the retailers and the consumers, because you look at the big retail chains in Britain now that have said they're going to take only
organic
materials or only sustainable wood or something like that. These are major retail firms, and they are doing very well. Pity we haven't got one in New Zealand that's, or people in New Zealand that are really pushing that as avidly.
I agree. I'm speaking with Diana Shand, who is the Regional Councillor for Oceania of the International Union for Conservation of Nature. Diana, what are some of the real good little positive things that have happened in New Zealand recently? Yes, we managed to curtail the government's desire to want to mine under our parks, but there has been some other good things happening too, has there not?
Oh, yes, and it happens at every level. There's business networks for sustainability, sustainable business network. Isn't that a great concept that young professionals are getting together to actually learn and then promote sustainability? Extraordinary thing. And again, in the business world, because I do come from a marketing and business background, the whole concept of the Business Council for Sustainable Development, out there doing excellent research, really promoting the idea of sustainable business. And that actually does overseas markets a lot of good, to think that New Zealand has a clean green image right through to the companies that are supporting these sort of things. Very important, actually, for our economic futures. But let's face it, in the here and now, everybody does want to be employed, though I think, of course, we could look seriously at some flexible employment. I'm not sure that we all need to be working a 40-hour week. Why don't we cut the working week down to 30 hours and share the employment round? That's a concept. I think that there is some good education going on in schools. I'm very sad the funding has been pulled for Enviro schools, but some local councils have picked up the funding for that. Those things get harder, that may go. But some local councils have been wonderful, supporting Enviro schools and doing some excellent projects themselves. And of course, you've got Waitakere City Council has led the way with its EcoPrint in the past, and Hamilton City and other, I look at New Plymouth, wonderful people, leaders there, and some really great moves that have happened. And Nelson City wanting to be a solar city. There's been some excellent local government work, and I think that that should be supported. And Greater Wellington City climate change strategies. I think if we acknowledge these things and say, this is the kind of politician we want in local government, and then go on to say these are the things the kind of politician we want in government, then we're going to get some change there, and we're going to get change in the business community supporting them and being supported as well. So when I look at the technology and the great thinking that comes out of New Zealand, there are some excellent things. In the communities, this transition towns.
Very good.
Very good. And the community groups that are out there doing lots of restoration, very important. It's the restoration and the maintenance of wetlands and peatlands that are sequestering carbon that is extremely important. Mangroves have a huge role, actually, sequestering carbon. They're starting to recognise this, and the worry around the world from clearing mangroves, which also, of course, great protection on our coasts for tsunamis and other
tidal surges.
Very, very important. So that's the sort of thing that people are doing in the community that I think is very exciting and very interesting. Everybody can join a local conservation environment organisation or get their local Rotary Club or whatever to take action in this front. So these are the good things that New Zealand is quite famous for, actually. And it's funny, when you talk about the organisation in which I'm a member of the Global Council, I'm very honoured to be that, I think there was a New Zealander right back in the founding stages involved. I think it was 1949 that a New Zealand scientist was invited to be part of this new organisation and have been prominent within it ever since. New Zealand scientists and New Zealand economists and contributors on the World Council. Really excellent people. And now we have in New Zealand Araha Mead, actually chair of one of the World Commissions, Environment, Economic and Social Policy. So New Zealand has been playing its part and should continue to do so. We have a lot to contribute in terms of knowing how to manage small islands, some of the work we're doing has been really exciting. So an invasive species, I think we're known throughout the world as being the organisation to call in to share our expertise and how you rid islands of rats or goats or whatever it is and how you tackle some of the invasive species problems. Very, very important to acknowledge that.
The artwork of having these islands off the coast, fortunately we're lucky to have so many islands that we can have all our natural fauna and flora like it was 10,000 years ago virtually, can't we?
But isn't it sad we've lost it from the mainland? So tragic. But wonderful, these mainland islands. Absolutely fantastic living in Wellington to take people up to Zealandia, as they call the Karori Sanctuary now. Zealandia has the most magnificent display on the natural history of New Zealand. And to hear the wildlife in that sanctuary and to see birds that you've never seen elsewhere, it's just magic. It's so good. And here in Auckland, of course, you've got Te Tiriti Matangi, which is an extraordinary, extraordinary example of what can be done in restoration from a bare island to now harbouring Takahi. Oh, it's just wonderful.
It's quite interesting. I think when Captain Cook came to New Zealand, he came to Queen Charlotte Sound early in the piece, and in Banks's diary, they woke up one morning when they anchored in the sound and they could hear this cacophony of sound of thousands, if not half a million, birds singing the dawn chorus. They said it was just so overwhelming. But the dark side of it all was that they had tied the ship to a tree on the shore, and the crew had noticed in the night rats running along the rope up into the trees, and of course we know what happened next. Western rats went in, and from then on it decimated it. And so right from square one. So we have to be always alert to our actions. Everything has a consequence, hasn't it?
Oh, you know, in poor little New Zealand, we've lost so many species. As thousands of animals and plants around the world are facing extinction from actions just like that, really, coming onto an unknown world that had evolved its special ecology, and then you introduce invasive plants and species and you take over habitat and you lose those very, very precious plants and animals which we are going to depend on, and we do depend on. Healthy biodiversity is absolutely essential for good functioning systems, for retaining our water, for purifying water, for giving us food and harbouring the healthy insects that will keep away other pests, for example, reduce our dependency on agrochemicals and sprays, all those sort of things. It's really worrying to think that we are losing species across the world at 1,000 times the natural extinction rate. It is really concerning to think that, according to the Red List, another IUCN special, that 1 in 4 mammals, 1 in 8 birds, 1 in 3 amphibians, and 1 in 3 corals are at risk of extinction in the wild over the next 10 years or up until 2050. Just appalling that we may be losing half the species on Earth by 2050. This is the real threat that really, really worries real scientists. And New Zealand and others have signed up to really starting to halt this. But we have to see this permeating through all government actions and all actions of the community.
Well, the statement you just made about what we could lose, who's standing up and saying this to the Prime Minister and say, speak on this subject right now to the people? Nobody. And it hasn't been done to any Prime Minister. We are not taking these questions to the leaders of this country.
I assure you, the delegation to Nagoya, where this biodiversity convention was specified for the next 10 years, I assure you that that delegation contained a government official.
But a government official, an unknown, unnamed government official, we want the leaders. We want to have the leaders telling us, Diana, really.
Yeah, I agree. But, you know, those government officials, they're in contact by fax and email and phone to Wellington all the time. They're on those delegations, getting the go-ahead to support positions. And as a consequence, they would have a responsibility to report back report back through the officials to Cabinet, and so the Prime Minister and everybody else is briefed. They are briefed. They do know the situation.
Yet the Prime Minister is also wanting to open up a whole coal mining venture in the South Island that's going to make New Zealand totally self-sufficient in diesel. You know the story that Jeanette Fitzsimons there. So here's our Prime Minister supposedly wanting to take care of his children and everybody else's children in this country, undermining us by wanting to drag coal out of the ground.
It is really distressing. You know, you have many loud voices coming to politicians, and it seems the voices for the future are not there. The voices that will actually protect the future and the grandchildren and the children. Some of these things are going to affect, well, very shortly. It is not a matter of just being way off in the future. It's really, really a distressing situation that species will just continually, and ecosystems will be continually lost. And with them, all the services that they give to this world, all that clean air, all that carbon sequestration, all that ability to adapt to climate change. So, yes, there are contradictions, and we should be pointing them out at every step. We simply have to be saying, for example, that dairy farming in the Mackenzie country, why are we there? Think of all that effluent and how it's going to get into the waterways. And what do we do with this? Dairy farming, I don't believe, is viable in the Mackenzie country at all. And we lose a magnificent landscape which brings tourists here and is treasured by people in New Zealand, gives us our spiritual health, our feeling of having this unique place that is ours and we belong to. That landscape is kind of our icon, our iconic landscape, isn't it? Revered and recorded by painters and artists of all followings. So I think that we really have to acknowledge that we have a job to pressure the media, to pressure our politicians, our local politicians, and politicians that have a responsibility to be responsive leaders and leaders in their own right. They should be also taking some responsibility for getting the knowledge and understanding that they must be standing up for nature and its role for people.
As a sustainer of the human species, because our politicians don't even know where their air comes from, really. I mean, they're so disconnected. But when I look at, say, the Maoris, they will have a pōwhiri about a subject. American Indians had a powwow. What it means is that we need to have our parliament speak just on one subject, not having a debate on it, trying to score points. Have the subject out in the open and have a mediator there and have it on television so that these very important and pertinent facts that we're losing so much biodiversity on this planet, and at the same time we're polluting everything. No medium is available for us, Diana, to access it. We'll go home tonight there and there'll be a murder on TV every night. I mean,
we should be ringing up the TV station. We should be complaining about the content on TV.
It's trash.
It is trash. Well, I actually turn off my TV.
I don't have a TV.
I really find it not worth following. Though I like following Māori TV. It has some good homegrown shows like we used to have on TV.
I agree. They're doing the job that TV1 is not doing.
Oh, it's so sad. I have to say, you know, for example, the New Zealand delegation over at Cancun at the moment is supporting some of the worst aspects of forestry, that you are not going to have your emissions counted, the increased emissions are counted, if you cut down forests and you mine peatlands, which are all great carbon sequesters, and you drain wetlands with another carbon sequester. And that means if you do those things, you cut down forests, you drain wetlands and you mine peatlands, that you actually are increasing your emissions, and you might then plant monocultural plantation and say that you are
pulling CO2 out of the air.
Pulling CO2 out of the air, and you're getting credits for it, but you don't count the minuses, the losses that you've just incurred. And the New Zealand delegation supporting this. This is appalling state.
I mean, who... Tim Grosser is the one who's leading this delegation, correct? Yes. Anyway, Well, obviously there's hypocrisy everywhere. We are living a lie. We're selling clean, green New Zealand, and in actual fact what we're doing is we're decimating it.
So let's speak out, Tim. Let us go home, pick up the telephone, complain to the TV and the radio station, and let's really say that our voice has to be heard. Let's every single person join a conservation and environment organisation and let everybody take the first step by actually cutting down on their electricity use, by actually making sure they don't waste, and thinking every time they go and shop that they actually need this extra thing that's such a bargain, sitting next to the thing they really needed that they originally went to shop for. That's the sort of thing that we have to do. Every purchase has to be a conscious one.
Very conscious purchase.
Every ride in your car needs to be a conscious one. And every time you turn on the tap, it has to be, do you need to leave it running? All these things are so important. And talking to your neighbour and saying, yeah, we really have to be treating the planet better. We really have to be conscious of these things. You know, it's so popular to deride greenies. But, you know, everything that the greenies talked about at the beginning of the decade is now true. Agenda 21, you just talked about it. Agenda 21 was an agenda for actually cleaning up pollution, addressing deforestation, cleaning up air pollution. It was an agenda for doing things that are now just accepted. So what we have to consider is that the new threats, the new concerns, this galloping land grab across the world, for example, which is happening in New Zealand too.
Yes, you can't buy land in China, you can't buy land in Japan. But
so they come and buy it here.
That's right.
It's an American bank that's buying land right through South America, for example. New York-based bank bought an area at the size of Dubai from a warlord in South Sudan last year. Those are the sort of things that are just so worrying when you're actually considering it's big corporations seeing the chance for exploitation, and that only leads to local communities' loss and more deforestation so forth, and loss of food for the millions. So we do have to address these things, and we can. And look out the window. Nature's so beautiful. What would we do without the birds? What would we do without this beautiful nature that we have, the flowers that it brings us, the indigenous landscape full of absolute wonders that are unique. We have such extraordinary uniqueness in our biodiversity. Why don't we say this is the heritage we're so proud of? You know, why don't we fill our garden up with native plants first and be really proud of it? That's the sort of thing we have a responsibility as New Zealanders to do, and that's the sort of thing that just makes it popular across the world, to protect your own biodiversity, to protect the natural world, and to revere nature. And we can do it.
And see it as sacred.
And it is.
It is, particularly when you have the fragrances of different flowers, particularly at night time, the different perfumes, and the night may be a balmy night, and close to a beach.
And we should be hearing more pork.
That's right. Well, we
and
need
the
to
lovely,
be...
the birds that come out at night, and you know, it wouldn't be wonderful to hear weka and kiwi scratching around in the bush. Gosh, it's a beautiful world, and we really have to recognise that every part is important to us.
Particularly for our children and our grandchildren.
Absolutely.
Diana, thank you very much for coming in and cranking it for us, because we cannot fall back into slumber. We cannot allow ourselves to miss this opportunity now to grow inside and become enriched within as we take care of the outer world.
Thank you. It was great to be here with you, Tim.
That was Diana Shand, who is a regional councillor for Oceania of the IUCN, the International Union for Conservation of Nature, and their website is IUCN.org. IUCN.org. I would like to draw your attention to the Green Planet Earth Files. This is a section of this program that covers points of interest that you, as listeners, can become involved. This way, the Green Planet program can facilitate positive options to bring about reducing our ecological footprint, acting in truly sustainable ways, and work towards becoming more carbon neutral. I'd like to talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. The TPPA is a free trade deal being negotiated at the Sky City Casino in Auckland all this week between 8 countries, including the USA. The website is tppwatch.org. tppwatch.org. Trade is only a minor part of this agreement. That's just a clever branding exercise. A TPPA would be an agreement that guarantees special rights to foreign investors. If these negotiators succeed, they will create a mega treaty across 9 countries that will put a straitjacket around what policies and laws our governments can adopt for the next century. Think GM labelling and not having GM labelling. Foreign investment laws. Remember The Hobbit when Warner Brothers came down and decided that they wanted employment laws changed and hence the government changed the laws? And look at medicines. Medicines, prices of medicines may go up hugely because they're dominated by overseas pharmaceutical conglomerates. And looking at finance firms, they might not regulate them. And for New Zealand content on TV, we may see even fewer New Zealand films, documentaries and actors on TV. Yes, this is important because foreign ownership of land and resources is now the big game plan, including mining licenses, media laws, and not supporting local New Zealand content. Treaty settlements could be involved or overridden. Plain packaging could be on cigarettes. Privatisation for water, prisons, schools and hospitals are under public-private partnerships that could really corner the market for vested interests. All this is really important. Now, this TPP agreement, like multilateral agreement on investment, this, of course, sounds like the MIA that we defeated in the 1990s, the multilateral agreement on investment. This TPP situation is effectively a bill of rights for large corporations that is designed in secret and shackles future governments and our democratic right to decide policies and laws by New Zealanders for New Zealanders. And this has been looked at by our government right at this moment. And it's all been signed quietly behind doors with no input whatsoever by the New Zealand Herald, by TV1, TV3, Radio New Zealand. It is essentially sliding in under the door and nobody knows. Remember the old axiom, you get the government you deserve. If we are not participating in democracy, we are then victims of politics. And what is happening at the moment is that the Labour Party are saying nothing. The Green Party are keeping quiet. The Māori Party, other than Honi Harawira, are hiding. If you want a country where children can have freedom to participate in life, in community, in a future where we are one country, one nation, one people, the time is now. It is imperative that you study what is happening at present and become involved. With tppwatch.org, be alert to what is happening. This is Earth Files for this week. At 9:05 Thursday, this program is streamed from the Planet FM studios on planetaudio.org.nz, search Green, or iPod and stream can be obtained 6 hours after broadcasting on greenplanetfm.com, holisticliving.co.nz, and itunes.com, search health. So thank you for tuning into this greenplanetfm.com program. I trust you feel empowered to make a difference, to play your part in this magnificent experiment called life, as it fulfills our purpose. I look forward to interviewing another insightful and perceptual practitioner next week. I wish you success in your work and your life with your family and within your community. This is Tim Lynch. In the spirit of Aroha, south of the Tropic of Capricorn, saying bye-bye and haere rā.